London, would you mind if we asked you a couple more questions about the new statute? See if you can help us. You've been helpful so far. Yes. And that goes for Ms. Groh as well. In the definitional section, section 53, it says a design-build contract is a contract between a contracting unit and a design builder. Contracting unit is defined earlier in that section as a government entity that enters into contracts pursuant to the local public contracts law.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Okay, under the local public contracts law, an entity that is defined as a contracting unit is subject to it if you're operating under the local public contracts law. A county improvement authority is a contracting unit if they are operating under the local public contracts law.
So if you are a contracting unit, where does it say in the new statute that you need not abide or that the entity awarding the contract need not abide by the local public contract law?
I'm sorry, I'm not following that.
You have to give the contract to the lowest bidder.
If, unless you're exempt from the local public contracts law. There's a list of exemptions for contracts that are not subject to the public contracts law in the local public contracts law under section 5.
Before the lunch break.
Yes.
I think we left with the understanding that your argument was that a design build contract would not require full compliance with the local public contract law. No?
No. It is a type of procurement that is allowed under the local public contracts law. And if you are choosing to follow design build, you have to follow the specific regulations that the law referred to in order to utilize that process. So there's a set, a very detailed set of regulations that will be attached if you so choose to use design build. And those regulations are similar to those under the State School Development Act.
And when bids are submitted and evaluated, there's a composite score and that takes in multiple factors beyond the lowest bid. Is that fair?
Yes. A review of the draft regulations indicated that there would be a process similar to what we used, in the sense that there's an RFQ, a request for qualifications, a ranking, a review, and this is just the qualification stage. Once you were shortlisted, you would move on to receive a request for a proposal. And those entities that have been shortlisted would be allowed or permitted to submit a proposal where you would have your technical proposal and a price. So that, and then they're scored, and all of this is set forth before you do the procurement. So it's transparent what type of process you're using.
Under the local public contracts law, contracts are awarded to the lowest responsible bidder, correct?
Correct. Now, this
is that true under this new law?
This allows another process similar to the other processes allowed under the local public contracts law. Under the local public contracts law, it allows or requires a straight competitive contract, or it also allows competitive contracting under, I think, section 4.1, and it allows other types of procurement, even under the local public contracts law, but not subject to a straight bid.
Right.
So the local public contracts law isn't limited just to a lowest responsible bidder. Under that law, you are allowed to do other things if you fall within the exceptions specifically under that law. And one of the added exceptions...
Which exception would get you into design build without public bidding being the be-all and end-all of this?
Well, the new statute, the new section would allow you to do that without going to the lowest responsible bidder.
And it would be the exception in the LCPL for other statutes?
Yes, there... In the local public contracts law, there are numerous other exceptions, and they identify the specific law that's involved and sets forth the process. Usually it's, a lot of them are with respect to wastewater facilities,
My question is, what exception to the LCPL gets you into a statutory selection process in which the amount of a bid is only one of many factors?
The new section, section 53, which allows for design build process.
So there's a new LCPL exception for design build that refers to this statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the contracting unit unilaterally decides on its own whether it is going to go through this process that does not require public bidding.
And in the regulations, it sets forth criteria and things that you have to meet in order to do that.
Right, it has to be over $5 million in a bid.
Right, this very specific criteria in order to satisfy, to utilize that exception.
Finish your, please.
No, you can go ahead.
That's like a fairly sizable hole in the local public contracting law. Is it fair to say?
Well, it's not a hole. And you have to look at it. It's not just picking someone. It's a very detailed process. Design build is a very detailed process. But it allows the contracting unit to look at things other than just a price. And in some types of contracts, you want to be guided by other than just the lowest bidder.
And this is not just limited to redevelopment.
It's
for all contracts.
Yes.
So if a contracting unit decides for every contract from now until eternity, they're going to use the design build, they're able to avoid the public bidding?
Well, it's not avoiding it. It's using an alternative. And there's a lot
that
goes into
it. But a contracting unit could do that.
Well, it's easier, quite frankly, to do a straight bid because the design build has way more components and requirements in it that the contracting unit has to follow. But again, the contracting unit will look at what they are procuring and does it make sense to go through the more detailed design build process or just do a straight competitive bid? Plus, do they meet the criteria of the design build?
Which allows for greater discretion in the hands of the contracting authority.
Which provides more discretion? Definitely design build, because you're looking at a whole plethora of other factors besides just a strict price.
There's a transparency provision in the statute, so the public gets to know what all the bids were.
Yes.
So it's not like anything is, it's not like the bids are swept under the rug. The public's going to know who the lowest bidder was.
Yes. And the bidder will know, or the respondent will know in a design build, who makes the short list or the criteria that goes into determining who makes the short list. All of that has to be set forth up front. You can't do it after the fact.
And is the scoring, both the individual and the composite scoring, made public as well?
Yes.
Counsel, was this statute before the appellate division when you argued it?
That was in April. I don't recall when we argued.
The appellate division's opinion was released in July of 2011.
June 1 was the argument date.
And June 1 was the argument date.
The law was signed, I believe, in April, so it was moving through the process at the time the case was moving.
But you argued it, you said the law was introduced in April of 2021.
I believe that's the date it was signed.
It's effective April 30, 2021. So it would have been law at the time of the
The time of the appellate division. Did you raise this issue with the appellate division? It was law by the time it was heard.
I did not raise it specifically there because our argument before the appellate division was that we had discretion under the redevelopment law to decide which process we were going to use.
You're not here saying this applies to this case as is. You're raising this to demonstrate that the legislature has set up a new process that
added a process,
added process for future. You're not arguing that this is the governing statute for this case as it's presented to the court.
Correct,
now.
And the decision from the appellate division has a reference allowing the BCIA to proceed in the future under the local public contracts law if it chooses to do so.
Right, and you're also alerting us to the consequences of the court's decision in terms
yes.
of what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Triff.
Thank you, Justices. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing the design build amendment. First, it did not exist at the time the solicitation was issued. More importantly, I disagree that the design build amendment renders this decision.
Can you keep your voice up, please?
Sure, sorry about that, Your Honor. Renders this decision and this court's ultimate ruling as simply academic. The two are separate and distinct. The design build amendment is not an exception to the local public contracts law. It is merely another delivery vehicle available to public owners to procure the completion of certain projects. The most analogous vehicle that existed at the time of this solicitation was competitive contracting. That provides some discretion to a public agency, as opposed to your traditional, here's the plans, submit the price, lowest price gets it. Under competitive contracting, there are criterias. Those criterias are evaluated. That evaluation is made available to the public. The design build amendment, although we don't have the regulations yet, so to some extent we're guessing as to what the requirements are, contains specific requirements that must be met prior to the solicitation even coming into existence, during the solicitation, and after the solicitation. Here, and the issue before the court, is whether somehow the redevelopment law excuses the improvement authority from its obligations under its enabling statute, the improvement authority's law. And the reason why the design build statute does not make this case and this court's ultimate ruling academic is because under the design build statute, there are parameters, strict parameters that must be followed, set by first the legislature, then the Department of Community of Consumer Affairs, and then ultimately that's an open process. And all those checks and balances must be met. Here, what the county and the improvement authority is arguing, we don't have to worry about that. We can decide the procedure. We can do whatever we want because the redevelopment law permits us to do so. The result, if that is true, is an end run of the local public contracts law, and in fact, would also be an end run to the design build amendment of the local public contracts law. Because no county would go through the process, the tedious process of satisfying all the requirements of the design build amendment if they could simply procure the project in whatever system they fashion behind closed doors, which is exactly what happened here. And Justice Ravdon, Chief Justice Ravdon, you began by asking a question, why would a redevelopment agency be required to follow the local public contracts law, but the redevelopment entity, which essentially becomes an agent of the redevelopment agency, would not? And I would submit that Justice Albin actually answered that question.
He often answers my
He actually answered several of my questions this morning. So it sort of will streamline the process a little bit from my perspective. But the redevelopment law specifically identifies two entities as expressly being subject to the local public contracts law, namely the redevelopment agency and the housing authority. And the reason why the legislature did that, as Justice Albin pointed out, is because the redevelopment statute is the enabling statute of those two entities. They didn't exist in law before that moment in time. So if the legislature did not do that, those two entities would in fact be carved out from the local public contracts law. The same is not true for the improvement authorities. There was an enabling statute. It preexisted, and as held, that existed, and its amendment existed, I believe, 13 or 17 years before the housing law came into existence. And what the improvement authorities law provides is that improvement authorities must comply with the local public contracts law. And as Justice Albin also correctly noted, 40A 12A4C specifically indicates that the improvement authority, when acting under or when acting as a redevelopment entity, is doing so subject to the county improvement authorities law. It's enabling statute. Public agencies can't exist outside of their enabling statute. They don't have the power to do so. And there is nothing in the redevelopment law that empowers an improvement authority to pay taxpayer money in exchange for a completion of a construction project without following the local public contracts law. And if you read the details of the powers that the redevelopment agency provides, it specifically uses terms like extend credit or provide a loan, which is completely different than the language used under the local public contracts law, which is to pay. And what is happening here is the improvement authority in the county is not extending credit. They're not providing a loan. They're in fact paying. And that's where it's important to go to the history of the redevelopment law. The history, as council properly indicated, is to help blighted communities. But what does the statute provide? And every case law that discusses the redevelopment law, other than the two unpublished decisions that ultimately the appellate division ignored and set aside for the reasons set forth in the decision, is a situation where you had a private developer that wanted to redevelop an area. And what the legislature determined is they want to encourage that redevelopment. So they created a system in which a private developer can come in, or conversely, a public owner, such as a municipal entity, can put out to private developers and say, here's an area. It's in need of redevelopment. And we would like you to redevelop it, so come propose it to us. Because the redevelopment law has two options. One is the municipality can go out to bid and say, hey, here's an area. Can you please submit bids for redevelopment? Alternatively, private developers can go to municipality and say, here's our proposal. And there's systems in place. But importantly, under the redevelopment law, the taxpayers are not paying for that redevelopment. The purpose of this statute is to allow private developers to get money to fund construction at low interest or no interest rates and build the project, the proceeds of which would go back to pay off the debt. That's what the redevelopment law is intended to do. That is what every case, published decision in this state interprets the redevelopment law as doing. It allows a private entity to come in, use the essentially credit of the municipal entity to get proceeds from the bond, use those proceeds to complete the project. The project generates revenues, and that private entity pays back the debt. That's not what is happening here. What is happening here is Bergen County is using Bergen County Improvement Authority to essentially construct, somewhat ironically, the Bergen County Courthouse, and then using taxpayers' money to pay Bergen County back. That's an end run to the local public contracts law. That is not extending credit. That is not providing a loan. That is paying for it. And when a municipal entity, or in this case, the county, or in this case, the county improvement authority, pays for services, whether it's design build, whether it's competitive contracting, or whether it's your traditional lump sum, lowest responsible bid, there's a process. That process is set forth under the local public contracts law. That is the only statute that allows an improvement authority, regardless of what hat it's wearing, to complete this project. There are nothing in the redevelopment law that allows a public owner, particularly the Improvement Authority, to pay out of taxpayer dollars to complete a public improvement. That's what's happening here. That is an end run. And this court's decision is critical because the statute of the local public contracts law that was recently amended to include design build, as I mentioned, does not change what is happening here and does not prevent future public owners to seek to end run the local public contracts law. So that is why this decision is critical. And
I didn't understand that to be their argument. That I thought their argument with respect to the design build amendments was that if they lose this case, they're simply going to send it back through a new process under design build, which they qualify for, they would qualify for, they say, and they're going to go through another process that's going to be consistent with current law. That's at least how I understood the significance of their references to, or counsel's reference to the statute.
I think that is correct, Your Honor. I was just addressing what I perceive to be Justice Albin's point, which is that this case ultimately becomes academic as a result of the design-build amendment.
Let me clarify. I didn't mean this case. I meant in the future. I meant in futuro. I didn't mean this case would become academic. I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Does it, from your perspective, does it make a difference whether it's an improvement authority, a county, or a municipality? If Bergen County or Hackensack was in the shoes of the Improvement Authority in this case, would they all be governed by the local public contracts law?
They would be, but through different vehicles. So, for instance, the County Improvement Authority's law only applies to an Improvement Authority, which ties into the local public contract law. The municipality is subject to the local public contracts law through separate statute. But the end result would be the same. Regardless of which public agency is doing it, they're subject to the local public contracts law.
The reason I'm asking this question is so we don't get the sense that it's just a carve-out for improvement authorities being subject to the local public contracts law. It would be any municipal or county entity.
Correct. Or say it differently, any public agency that's a local public agency. Obviously, the local public contracts law doesn't apply to the state or any entities of the state, but any municipality, improvement authorities or any other local public agencies are subject to the local public contracts law. And to the extent that they are permitted to serve as a redeveloping entity or an agency under the redevelopment law, they can only do so subject to the local public contracts law, where, as here, they're actually paying taxpayer dollars. If, for instance, this was a true situation where you're extending credit to a private entity, then the local public contracts law would not apply because taxpayer dollars is not being used to fund the project. It's more of a loan or an extension of credit, which is what you typically see in the context of a redevelopment project.
Your adversaries make the point that there's a difference between a redevelopment authority created by the county improvement authority or existing under the county improvement authority law. And a redevelopment entity existing pursuant to redevelopment law. And that's one of the distinctions here. Is there that difference or distinction?
Between a redevelopment entity and a redevelopment agency?
Authority, a redevelopment authority. They use the word authority.
So the two terms used in the redevelopment law is redevelopment entity and redevelopment agency. Redevelopment agency, redevelopment entity is the municipal entity. That's statutory as defined.
Municipality?
Yes, it's a municipality. So, for instance, in this case, it would be Hackensack. And under the redevelopment law, the municipality, Hackensack, can appoint certain specific entities. In this case, it was the Improvement Authority as the redevelopment agency. And in this particular instance, what Hackensack had done is the entire downtown area of Bergen County, of Hackensack, has been declared many, many, many years ago in need of redevelopment, and is now subject to the redevelopment law. As it relates to this specific property, namely the Bergen County Courthouse, and only the Bergen County Courthouse, Hackensack prescribed through resolution that the Improvement Authority can be the redevelopment entity for that property and that property alone. And that's what brings us here.
Is that, and their argument is, under that circumstance, a redevelopment entity is not, because of the language of the redevelopment law, not subject to local public contracts law, whereas a redevelopment agency would be. Is that correct or incorrect?
That is their argument. However, it is incorrect because, as Justice Albin pointed out, 48.12.8.4c specifically says a redevelopment entity, in this case the Improvement Authority, where it is an Improvement Authority, is subject to the County Improvement Authority's law. The County Improvement Authority's law then provides that whenever an Improvement Authority pays money to a private entity, it must do so in accordance with the local public contracts law. So under the redevelopment law, there could be no scenario where a redevelopment entity, when it happens to be an improvement authority, can somehow escape its obligations, both under its enabling statute, the county improvement authorities law, and also the local public contracts law.
Council, let me read this part of the appellate division opinion. Nothing in our case law suggests that by giving county improvement authorities the power to contract with the redevelopers, the legislature intended to allow a public agency to use public funds to pay a general contractor while complying with the local public contracts law. Simply by denoting the contractor as a redeveloper. Is that what you think occurred here? Is that what you think happened here? Is the appellate division correct in framing it the way they did? That by creating the Bergen County Improvement Authority as an entity, it's a way of getting around the requirements to be subjected to the public contracts law?
Yes, I don't see what other reason why. Because as I mentioned, the local public contracts law has strict requirements and strict parameters in order to let out a project. And now even the design build amendment is not an easy task.
So could Hackensack, instead of designating the BCE, the Bergen County Improvement Authority, could they have gone directly to a contractor and asked as a developer agent to submit a bid for this project?
The short answer is yes, but here's the problem. Hackensack doesn't own the building. The building is owned by the county. So the only reason why Hackensack became involved is to help the county to essentially circumvent the local public contracts law. The county could not, in and of itself, declare the county courthouse in need of redevelopment.
Well, there was something else going on, and tell me if I'm mistaken. This whole leaseback business, tell me if I'm mistaken, is so that the Bergen County Improvement Authority could float the bonds and Bergen County wouldn't have a general obligation. They're lease payments, but they're not obligated for the bonds, the Improvement Authority. It separates Bergen County. Am I mistaken?
So that's partly correct. So the reason why they broke it up is in order to make this appear to be your traditional redevelopment, where you have an owner paying leases back to the tenant. And that's why the property was shifted back and forth. But in terms of the bond, the bonds that are issued are actually backed by the county itself. The principal and the interest is backed by the county itself. So it's tantamount to the county issuing its own bond. And that in of itself also violates the redevelopment law, because the redevelopment law does not permit a county to pledge taxpayer dollars to fund the loan or to fund what is typically the loan or the credit. That's supposed to be backed by the property and the proceeds of the redevelopment. Here, and this is again why this violates it, is because the taxpayer dollars are exposed. In the end of the day, there's only one source of revenue to pay for this, taxpayer dollars. So yes, they shifted the property back and forth in order to create the appearance of your traditional redevelopment project. But in terms of the funding, because the county had to backstop the debt, both the principal and the interest, under case law and under bond law, the county is on the hook, just like the Improvement Authority is. And if the county is on the hook, the taxpayers are on the hook.
I want to read to you another line from the appellate division. And tell me if you agree or disagree with this, or you can give me some explanation. Defendants argue that pursuant to the LRHL, redevelopment entities are permitted to choose a redeveloper without public bidding. We have no quarrel with this general proposition. What do you have to say about that?
I agree, because traditionally the redeveloper is, in my example, and what is traditionally seen, a private entity that's coming in to build in, for instance, an apartment complex or, you know, a multi-use complex, which is what you commonly see.
Okay, so your understanding of that is when public monies are not being expended.
Correct. And that is when you traditional, it's a lease or credit. And even the even under the redevelopment law, there is a process in which a redeveloper has to get appointed or has to get selected, particularly where a private entity comes to a municipality without the municipality putting it out to quote-unquote bid. And in that instance, and this is not an issue here, but more for background, in that instance, the municipality is required to make it open for a certain period of time to see if there's other entities who might want to submit a counter proposal or may have an objection. But again, in this situation, the redevelopment law governs only because public dollars are not being paid in order to complete the project. It's private money that's essentially being treated as a loan using bonds that are backed by the ultimate project.
So the next obvious question is, you're articulating a very strong position. So why did DOPCO and its main principal object to this and demand that this competitive bidding process be applied? Why were you going through this, the process that they had, instead of objecting in a timely way?
Well, we believe that DOPCO did object in a timely way. And during, and what's alleged in the complaint is that at the initial phase, which is the only thing that we're talking about, this phase one, the qualification phase, DOPCO submitted questions to the public owner, essentially asking, how are you doing this? And I could say that because I was involved behind the scenes wondering, how are they doing this? This makes no sense to me. So during that solicitation process where there were questions, DOPCO was asking questions. They never got the answers. Ultimately, DOPCO did not make it to the next round, at which point in time, DOPCO and a taxpayer who, and I'll get to that in a moment, filed a lawsuit timely in order to challenge the manner in which the solicitation and the ultimate award was happening.
So and DOPCO did more.
I'm sorry?
DOPCO did more than simply ask questions. It participated in the solicitation process, right?
Correct. I think that's fair to say.
And under Autotight, then, it couldn't challenge that process after the fact, right?
Correct. And that's what the appellate division ultimately held.
Which is no longer in front of us.
Correct, Your Honor.
So what's left of Autotight if the very same person who signed a complaint on behalf of DOPCO puts on a different hat moments later and signs a similar complaint with similar legal theories as a taxpayer?
So I'll answer the question in a roundabout way and then a direct way, if that's okay. In terms of Autotight itself, it did not address the issue of whether an individual taxpayer who's involved with a company somehow loses its ability or his ability or her ability to challenge it and somehow loses their individual status as a taxpayer simply because they're also an owner or an officer of a company. Other decisions from this court, namely the Camden Parking Plaza v. Camden, and also the Warnock-Ryan Leasing v. State Department of Treasury, that was an appellate division case, those did deal with that issue. And in both those instances, both this court and the appellate division held that the individual, notwithstanding his involvement or ownership with the entity who no longer can challenge, they're still able to challenge because a taxpayer is a taxpayer. You know, Mr. Ibrahim still resides in Bergen County. He's still...
So what's left of Autotight?
Well, DOPCO, consistent with the appellate division decision, could not challenge it.
capable, smart lawyer, in the next case, once this is approved by this court, will say, go ahead and participate. Go ahead and try to get the bid through the solicitation process. And if you fail, just pursue this challenge as a taxpayer.
I think the taxpayer status and in the individual doesn't get lost. Mr. Brahim, as a resident, still pays taxes. He's entitled to vote. There's a standard for essentially piercing the corporate veil. And that's what this exact argument is somehow.
Respectfully, this is not piercing the corporate veil. This is an individual who signs a complaint that doesn't refer at all to his status as essentially a principal of Dobco, perhaps even the principal of Dobco. And then he certifies the Dobco complaint, thus representing to the court that he is the individual or an individual who speaks on behalf of Dobco. This is not some sort of corporate veil issue, respectfully, counsel.
The same standard for corporate veil, I would agree with Your Honor, wouldn't apply. I mean, that's fraud and so forth. But here,
On what basis? You're saying that the way to deal with this problem and the law saying that you can't both be a beneficiary of a process or a potential beneficiary and then say it's illegal when you don't prevail, if that's the principle that the law is pursuing, if all you need to do is have the same person who was the decision maker or the certifier as the principal of the corporate entity say, I'm now a taxpayer and here I'm just here as a taxpayer, then as the chief noted it, the case law doesn't mean anything anymore, because every corporation's going to have someone who's going to be able to do that ultimately, unless they happen to be from a different area.
And that may be so, but that's what the Camden Parking Plaza v. Camden decision held. And they basically, the Supreme Court held that despite the fact that the company participated, and by the way, so did the Warnock-Ryan Leasing v. State Department of Treasury, both of those cases held that despite the fact that the company participated in what it later argued to be an improper solicitation, the individual is still an individual, and he doesn't or she doesn't somehow lose their status as a taxpayer and the rights afforded to a taxpayer. Because again, the local public contracts law is not intended to benefit any contractor. The local public contracts law is intended to pay taxpayers. I'm sorry?
I think to any disinterested person, this would look like a complete like gaming of the system. You've got Dobco, okay, not requesting public bidding. And Dobco has a vice president, okay, and Ibrahim, inextricably intertwined. And this is what Justice Patterson is saying. You're going forward with the corporate entity, and the individual is, for all intents and purposes, the very embodiment of the corporate entity, therefore being able to make the challenge. It permits you to go both ways at the same time. I'll pursue this path, see if it works, hasn't worked. Okay, now let me challenge and undermine the entire process. It makes it a charade. So the question is, whether or not in these circumstances, Ibrahim equitably has unclean hands and should not be permitted to make this argument.
I mean, I would respond as this, and it would create a slippery slope. And here's why. When you have an officer of a company, you have a duty to the company. If you're an owner of a company, depending on the structure of the company, the bylaws, the membership agreements, etc., you have a duty, and to some extent, possibly a fiduciary duty to a company. If there is a bid, or a potential bid, and that is your work, you have to participate. But the fact that you're exercising your obligations and your duties as an officer or as a shareholder of a company does not negate or change the fact that that same individual has his own personal interest. So the slippery slope would be if you are a vice president of a company and the president directs you, submit this bid, but as a taxpayer, you're wondering, this doesn't seem right. But simply because I'm following orders of a president of the company, or simply because I feel I'm obligated as an officer of a company to participate in this process, somehow that prohibits me from, as an individual, challenging it?
That you should have challenged, as in, if you want to separate yourself from the company, then you do it in a timely way. I understand you're saying I'm under orders, but if you feel that strongly as a citizen, okay, even though you're with the company, then split off from the company and make your timely argument.
Well,
Ibrahim didn't do that. He followed orders. And now he wants to say, well, I'm no longer following orders. Let me sink this whole thing, not just for myself, for DOPCO. Like whose interest is he really advancing?
He'd be advancing his personal interests as a taxpayer.
So now he's following orders, doing everything for DOPCO, and suddenly he's the disinterested citizen carrying the flag for all the people of Bergen County, and is not advancing DOPCO's interests?
In his personal lawsuit, he's advancing his own interests, which is why DOPCO advanced its own interests through its own separate and distinct claim. And I understand the point.
In the Camden, I'm sorry, go ahead. In the Camden case, what was the role of the individual plaintiffs in the Camden entity that was doing the development, the parking plaza company?
I don't recall the individual's role.
Well, are you suggesting that in Yesenda and in Camden, that there was an analogous situation where principals of the two companies were coming in and saying they were individual plaintiffs?
Not Yesenda. It was Warnock Ryan leasing the State Department of Treasury.
Okay, so Warnock. Okay, because Yesenda was the one that the appellate division cited. So in Camden Parking Authority, are you saying that there was an analogous relationship to the company?
I believe there was in Camden. I'm certain in Warnock that there was. And Warnock is 194 NJ Super 11. That was an appellate division case. But I would also note, and only because we're talking about auto note, in the decision in auto note, the court also specifically held, and I'll read from the decision, we are concerned, however, with the statutory provision as to which there has been a paucity of judicial attention. The issue is one of substantial public importance, and large sums of public monies are at stake. The substantive issue before the court has been fully developed by both parties, and there's a strong likelihood that it would be raised again in the near future if we were to decline to reach it. Since the question is ripe for judicial resolution, and since a decision on the public bidding issue will serve the public interest, we address the merits of plaintiff's argument. I don't think anyone can dispute here that this matter is of substantial public importance. Even the Improvement Authority in its brief says this case, quote, this case transcends the immediate interests of the litigants. This transcends, Mr. Ibrahim, this transcends DOPCO. This is a matter of public importance. This is a matter that involves millions of dollars.
You so, advance the distinction between an individual who is following the company's line and doing what he has been told to do, and separately advancing his or her personal interests. I don't know if you're voicing that as a hypothetical for other cases or applying it in this case. Did DOPCO have an attorney that it paid for that was separate and apart from counsel for Mr. Ibrahim, and did Mr. Ibrahim pay for it out of his own pocket?
The first answer to the question is no. I represented, and my firm represented, both DOPCO and Mr. Ibrahim because we don't perceive their claims to be in conflict with one another as it relates to this matter.
Not suggesting there's anything wrong with that.
And as to payment, I don't know. I don't know how or who the money was paid for on the back end of DOPCO, so I can't answer that question.
Assuming that we were to accept your argument with respect to Mr. Ibrahim's role as a citizen, would DOPCO still remain barred from participating in any future bid, given its participation, its unclean hands in this case, if we were to avoid this process? And would they be precluded from participating? Got DOPCO.
No, under the local public contracts law, there are certain circumstances where a bidder becomes precluded from participating in a subsequent award. I don't remember all the potential outcomes. I don't believe this would be one of them. I don't believe a challenge to a solicitation automatically disqualifies an entity from participating in the next round. But there are circumstances under the local public contracts law where a bidder would in fact be disqualified in the next solicitation. So that could exist. I don't believe it would exist here.
Go on the back end, you don't know if there were adjustments on the front end?
All I know is where we received payment from. I don't know how that was allocated among the company and, you know, Mr. Ibrahim.
I take it from that company. The company paid the legal bills for both.
Correct, Your Honor.
And who knows what happened thereafter is what you're saying.
Correct. I don't know how the adjustments, if there was adjustments or anything on the other end, on the back end of that. So unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I see you moving. You didn't ask for a rebuttal.
I know. I forgot, Your Honor. I'm starstruck.
We'll hear you first.
It'll be very, very good.
Please.
My glasses broke at lunch, so it has to be brief.
A few points. The propriety of the funding is not before this court. Mr. Counsel for respondent talked a lot about the funding mechanism and what he perceived as it being wrong. The appellate division even noted that was not before the appellate division either, because it was not part of the issues on appeal. So that's not before this court. Secondly, Justice Albin noted that the appellate division made a statement that defendants contend that a redevelopment entity has flexibility in entering into a redevelopment agreement without complying with the public contracts law, and they didn't disagree. Neither did counsel for respondent. How do you reconcile that with the position I'm hearing from some of your honors that if there's no language in the redevelopment law saying it's not subject to the local public contracts law, how do you carve that out? So point that out. Lastly, Justice Albin also made a point saying that the provision in 1240A:12-23 that makes redevelopment agencies and housing authorities are subject to the local public contracts law. Your Honor said, well, that's because redevelopment entities were already subject to it. And I will say this, redevelopment entity is created by the redevelopment law, just like a redevelopment agency, just like a housing authority. The only place you see it defined is in the redevelopment law. It defines what the term is there. If you go into the county improvement authorities law, you don't see the word. The only time, and I was on my phone, I wasn't texting anybody, I was looking at Westlaw. The only time you see redevelopment entity in the county improvement authorities law is by a way of a cross reference in the title, the initial section of the law. It's nowhere within the county improvement authorities law. I bring that distinction.
One question. In your brief, you state that the Camden Plaza parking versus City of Camden case, as well as two others that are not really the subject here, does not stand for the proposition that an agent of a principal who actively participated in the public procurement process is not barred from challenging a public procurement if he were is a taxpayer. I don't have a copy of the case here with me, but does the Camden Plaza parking versus City of Camden case deal with a situation analogous to this, where you have a principal essentially wearing two hats in this process, one speaking on behalf of the corporate entity, and secondly, as an alternative, proceeding as a taxpayer?
No, Your Honor. They were taxpayers. They were separate and apart and distinguishable from the bidder in that case. In that case, they found that those taxpayers did have standing to take issue with the bidding process. They had no relationship to the unsuccessful bidder.
That was my recollection.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure that's correct.
Yes, and in the I believe the appellate division noted that in a parenthetical explanation.
Are you familiar with the Warnock case that has been cited today in oral argument? I'm not familiar with that.
No, Your Honor. I did try to see it real quick in respondent's brief. And I think that was just trying to draw the distinction between a principal and the company. not necessarily in the terms of unclean hands or estoppel arguments. I don't believe there's any law that specifically finds that particular issue. There is the case is closest, I think, is the straw man case, which was the third case cited.
Yesenda? Or
no, it wasn't Yesenda, I believe.
PWA?
The communications workers. That was where the union, the taxpayers, and they were saying that they weren't straw men of the union. In this case, I said, you don't have to look to see whether he's a straw man. He's the guy. He's one of the shareholders. He's not only the vice president, he's a shareholder. He's one of two shareholders. So I think that, you know, if there's any other questions, I'm happy to address them.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
A set of questions, and it was helpful to have your assistance on it all around. We'll take the matter under advisement.